Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets. My not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be with you this evening and grateful you've decided to spend your time with us tonight. Long before I was part of the Coast to Coast team, you know, I would tune in and listen to the program, not every night, of course, but often enough, especially when it was a UFO guest or a UFO topic. I know there are a small number of listeners who groan when we cover UFOs, but to me, that subject is at the very heart of what Coast to Coast is about. I mean, it's an enduring, perplexing mystery, strange and terrifying and wonderful all at the same time because it has so many different aspects to it. My journalism colleagues, a lot of them anyway, are so often quick to dismiss the UFO subject. They characterize it as just about flying saucers from other planets or little green men peeking in your window at night, odd lights in the sky, they're probably explainable, those kind of things. But that is really, all of those things, just a tiny little pieces of this mystery. I mean, I've been plugging away at it, I guess, wearing my reporter's hat for more than 25 years, and I'm still learning something new about it almost every day. It's so much bigger, wider, deeper than the simple notion of non-humans visiting our little planet to check us out or see what we're up to. And if you're one of those who simply are not interested or who sell it short by characterizing it as a simple misunderstanding of what we're seeing in the skies, have been seeing for centuries, I don't know what to say. If ever there was an Exhibit A in a court case to prove just how big the UFO subject has grown, how large this particular subject matter has grown, it's the newest book by historian Richard Dolan. It's called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, A Fresh Guide to an Ancient Mystery. And while it covers many of the big issues and best-known cases of the last 70 years, stuff that maybe we've kicked around once or twice, its most glaring and important achievement, at least in my opinion, is its flat-out, hands-down, holy moly expose of just how humongous this field has become. The tentacles it's grown. How it reaches into politics and government, into science and academia and business, into mass media and journalism, and right into the lives of billions of people on this planet, whether we care to admit it or not. Tonight, we're going to cover a lot of ground. New cases, new issues, new challenges. Some of it, a fairly harsh examination of the colorful personalities and crackpot cases and woo-woo trends that pop up from time to time, but also the trail of evidence, solid evidence, the Byzantine path this subject has taken in the past half century or so, wrapping itself around the collective consciousness with the grip of some ultra-dimensional super being. Where we've been, where we're going, why this topic means something to you. And I think it goes to the heart of what we do on Coast to Coast. There is no better guest and guide for this trip we're going to take tonight than Richard Dolan. If you know him, you heard him here before. He's smart, he's honest, he's dogged in his pursuit of the different tenets of this mystery, no matter where they might lead. And a few of them do lead to fairly uncomfortable places. Richard is joining me for all 4 hours of tonight's program. We will, of course, open up the phone lines in the final hour so you can participate in the give and take as well. And I'd send out a special message tonight, call it a plea, I guess, to any of our listeners who are former military or former intelligence or former government operatives, those of you who might know something, might have seen something during your government service, might have been part of something that would help us to understand these mysteries. Maybe you wanted to tell someone for a long time, but you simply haven't for whatever reason. You've been holding it back. Well, let's make tonight the night. Retired spooks, ex-special forces, you former men in black or alien hunters, if you are out there, let us hear from you. At least think about it. Webmaster Tim Binall and I put together our usual assortment of news items and oddities for the Knapp's News section on the Coast to Coast website. A couple of these articles are directly related to our guest and topic tonight, There's an essay about how humanity might change if we knew aliens existed, aliens, non-humans, call them what you will. And Richard and I will be talking about that as well. A historical photo essay about ancient petroglyphs that seem to show big-headed non-human entities. A fun piece about an American hero and industrialist, Howard Hughes, what his connection to UFOs might have been. A disturbing review of a notorious drug plane that seems to be up to its propellers in the drug trade, but is also a favorite of certain U.S. government types. And check out the list of weirdest photos that have ever been taken, a few of them directly related to the UFO subject. It's a fun piece. And then two articles about the health of the planet, one about mass extinctions of species, the other about the terrible stuff we eat and the consequences of our diets. Take a look at those stories and more on the Coast website. Maybe sign up to become a Coast Insider while you're there so you can stream link this program and others. Listen to it anytime at your convenience. Costs only pennies a day. With that said, time to bring in the dog, toss a log on the fire, fire up a pot of Joe, slip into those warm jammies. Time now for our first break. When we come back, we'll get right to it with my guest, historian Richard Dolan, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. You know, I was thinking to myself while preparing for tonight's program how long I've known Rich Dolan, or known of him, and I don't want to date myself or anything, but I still have Rich in my head as, yeah, he's that new guy in ufology, the academic guy who's brought such a critical eye to the field. Well, he's not the new guy, not anymore anyway. He's been plugging away at this for 20 years now. His two-volume history of UFOs and the national security state is what I would say the most important historical look at the subject maybe ever, certainly since David Jacobs' history 30 years ago or so. And I think his new book is destined to become a landmark in the field for its depth and breadth. I mean, it covers the gamut, and in a way that Richard's previous books did not. It's much more personalized and introspective, and in this one, Rich Dolan calls them how he sees them. Again, it's called UFOs for the 21st Century Mind, and I am pleased to welcome my friend and colleague Rich Dolan back to the program.
Hello, George.
Hey, Richard.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start at the end of the book as a way to sort of set the stage for tonight. You have a quotation back there from the late Phil Klass, arch skeptic, debunker supreme, who delighted in mentally torturing UFO researchers and worse. He talked about the UFO curse, the curse being that every UFO researcher will go to their grave still just as mystified about UFOs as they ever were, the implication being we haven't learned diddly and we never will. Let's start there. Your rejoinder.
Well, yes. I'm glad you mentioned that. Many researchers have heard of this, and basically it's like you're going to die on your deathbed. You'll never learn anything more than you know now. But I've felt that that's really missing the point of something as significant as the UFO subject. First of all, I don't think it's true on the face of it. Over the decades, we have learned a number of things about the UFO phenomenon that researchers back in the 90s and 80s and 50s did not know. But I think the really significant thing is that it is the study of UFOs that I think in itself is of tremendous value to us, because what I have found is that it's opened the doorway into a myriad of just fascinating other subjects that are cutting edge in our society. And by unpacking the UFO mystery, we are really diving into many, many important issues that are critical for our own era. So that I think it's a short-sighted statement of his. I think we're lucky to have the opportunity to be embarking in this era of our own, of studying this greatest of mysteries.
You know, you cast such a wide net. I love the book. I think it's terrific work on your part, and mainly because of the wide net that you do cast. It isn't just about flying saucers, lights in the sky. I mean, George Norrie wrote in the foreword that it covers the gamut, and you write about it being, I think, a proper study of UFOs, you said, is a revolutionary experience and that it shatters old belief systems. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, this is where it does get personal, because I did start my journey into studying the UFO subject about 20 years ago, just over now, and it revolutionized my own belief system. So I can say this from personal experience. And by that, I simply mean this. I think all of us grow up in our society with this idea somehow of UFOs as this controversial subject, but it's very rare that in our official way of doing business, whether it's in the academic world or in the world of business, that the UFO subject is given any kind of serious attention. The problem is that if a person takes the time out of their life to begin studying the UFO phenomenon, really to study it and give it a chance to work its magic on you, what you find is it does transform your belief systems, because the very first question you're going to ask yourself is, wait, how can this be real when it's not supposed to be? When every authority in my society has said this isn't real, but yet it appears to be. So that's a big red flag right there. But then it opens up into a variety of other issues, like what does this say about my political system, and where are the journalists, and where's the academicians? And if there's a cover-up, how is the cover-up being paid for? And what are the U.S. presidents doing in all of this? And suddenly you have this cascade of incredible questions that force you to look into your society in a completely different way. That's not even getting into the scientific issues of what might make UFOs even possible. That is, how might an object zigzag through the sky? Not supposed to be possible, but we have reports of this. Or instantly accelerate straight up into the atmosphere. That alone, that type of propulsion science is revolutionary if we really allow ourselves to study it. To say nothing of questions dealing with interstellar flight or travel. How could such a thing be possible? Or even crazier science like dimensions or even consciousness itself. All of those sciences, as we find out, have their own intersection with the UFO topic. So what we find is that this topic, which is denigrated, which is marginalized, pushed off to the fringe in our society, is actually truly the most profound gateway into all of these fascinating cutting-edge issues that would, in fact, remake our world, our worldview, if we give it the chance.
You know, I think for some of your colleagues, historians, academicians, for some of my colleagues, journalists, when you get into a conversation with them, you want to sort of start the learning curve. It's hard sometimes. I mean, looking at the depth and breadth of your book, this wide net that you cast, you look realize how big the topic is. It's just easier for them to say, it's too hard. I'm going to take a pass on it.
Well, absolutely, George. I mean, what you find in this, I know you've seen this easily as much as I have, is in a lot of ways, the higher up the social ladder you go, the more resistance you get. I mean, it's the people who are intelligent and they have made a career for themselves. They've carved out their space in life, you know? And look, once you get to like 35, 40, 45, 50, you don't want to have to reinvent your whole worldview, especially when you're established in your profession. That's a really difficult thing to do. For me, many of the individuals who will come to me privately with some interesting story or comment are often the people who have retired. Many academicians, yes, but more of them having retired than active, in their career. I think they're intimidated while they're doing this in their career.
For some people, I think there is no amount of evidence or proof that would ever convince them it's real, that it's here, that it's non-human. You know, a saucer on the White House lawn, that's what they want to see. They want to see the body of a dead alien or something like that. And I suspect that if you came up with those things, even as improbable as they might seem, they'd still find a way to not believe that. But the fact is, there is a whole range of proof. You have an interesting sort of essay in the book where you start off with discussing proof, what constitutes proof and who decides it.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is one of these things that I think about a lot with this topic, because you get the skeptics saying, I need proof. They demand the proof. Okay, fine. Fair enough. So let's talk about what that would be. I think everyone would agree that an alien, live or dead, that could be studied by a team of scientists would be, yes, that should be proof right there. Okay, so we haven't had that out in the open. So that's a problem. So what other types of proof would there be? Well, obviously, photographs are not going to constitute proof, even though photographs can look pretty neat. We all know photographs can be fake. Same with video. Same with, what about multiple video? We don't have too many of those anyway, but multiple video, multiple witnesses, well, that would be better. But what you find with all of these, I mean, through the history of some of the best UFO cases, there are always going to be, and there have been, debunking attacks on all of them, whether they're specious or legitimate, all of these cases. So all of them, you know, they're in the crosshairs of individuals trying to shoot them down. And that's fine, by the way. We want to be able to shoot them down, because if they survive that, then they're stronger cases. But what it really occurred to me is it's not so much the proof that we're talking about as who is authorized to deem something proof. There have been a number of scientific studies of some really anomalous UFO and related types of events. Think of crop circle analysis. I'm not sure if I think I got into this a bit. I'm not sure. But, you know, there has been a number of studies done of the fields that show deformities in the nodes of the stalks. These are very scientific studies. They are they show strange things going on there. And yet they just kind of get tossed aside. It's like, well, you know, this private scientist here or this particular study over there. But so in other words, what we're really talking about is not a scientific issue so much as a political issue. It's and that's how science is done, too. We have to ask ourselves, you and I can't just go off and do science in our basement. Science is done as part of a large team that gets funding, and it's part of an organizational structure. And in other words, when we're talking about proof, we're talking about an authoritarian societal kind of system that is in place that makes that determination. And the only problem with that, I mean, there would be nothing wrong with that except for the fact that it seems to be the exact same hierarchy, which is intertwined with our political slash national security hierarchy. And there really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of independence in our bureaucratic scientific system. And certainly when we look at the history of how our organizational science has looked at UFOs, they haven't almost ever given it a real opportunity. There was the Condon Committee from 40 years ago, which was a joke. There really aren't these open scientific studies. So it's a real problem. What constitutes proof? What it really means is that we're not in so much of a democratic type of society like we want to believe. We're in a very top-down, authoritarian type of the system, because what we're implicitly saying is, I'll believe it when the president says it's true.
Yeah.
Or the head of the National Academy of Sciences or something like that, you know, some authority figure.
Or it's on CBS Evening News or something. I don't know if that would work anymore or not. You know, the scientists, we've heard it so many times. Gosh, I'd really like to get into this mystery, but there's really nothing to study. What they mean is you can't predict when a UFO is going to appear in the sky, a light's going to appear or something like that. But there is stuff to study. I mean, there's 2,500 landing site trace cases where, what does it say, UFOs set down. The irradiated soil, burned soil, messing with the trees. If you wanted to study it, you could.
Absolutely. One of the other problems, though, from a scientific point of view, and you know, if you and I were practicing scientists, this would be a frustration for us, because what most scientists want is they want control over their experiment. But what if we're dealing with a phenomenon of intelligences that are beyond our own intelligence? What is the likelihood, really, that a scientist is going to be able to have the kind of control that he or she would have over a bacterium in a plate? You're not going to have that same type of control when you're dealing with an intelligence that can run circles around you literally and figuratively.
And that doesn't want to be caught.
Exactly. So scientifically speaking, we're at a real disadvantage in that regard. And so it is a problem for science. But I think more than that, it is a political issue in terms of who is allowed to determine whether something or not is proof.
You know, what hooked me on the topic is probably the same thing that hooked you, and it's the paper trail. You know, I was trying to think of when I first started reading it, a guy named John Lear, you know who he is, of course, dropped this stack of government documents on my desk, and internal memos and reports that had been squeezed out of the government through the Freedom of Information Act, you know, and this is stuff that was never supposed to be seen by the public. What the military and political leaders were saying to each other behind closed doors, which turned out to be much different from what they were telling us then and now. And that's what hooked me. I mean, as a journalist, same as for you as an historian, We can't figure out when aliens are going to appear, but we can face the paper trail, and that's what we'll talk about when we come back in the next segment. We're talking with Richard Dolan, the author of UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I'm George Knapp, and the Four Tops take us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. That might be my favorite Bruce Springsteen song, recorded back in 1982. It is not about cars, Pink Cadillac. We're talking with Richard Dolan, historian, author of the new, massive new book, UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. When we come back, we look at some documents. You want to see a form of proof that suggests our government knows more than it's telling us. We're going to tell you about some of the paper trail and where it leads and what it proves. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So if you begin with a proposition that we are being visited, that there's interaction between humans and extraterrestrials, aliens, non-humans, ultra-dimensionals, time travelers, whatever you want to call them, why would the government cover it up? How could they get away with it? And Richard Dolan goes into great detail about sort of how it's happened over the years, and there's a paper trail to prove it, starting with, Richard, World War II. It doesn't start there, but that's an example you use, is that we were lied to right from the get-go. The example of the Battle of L.A., you mentioned that there were some lies told right off the bat.
Yes, absolutely, George. I think a lot of people are familiar with the Battle of Los Angeles, at least at this point. Hey, there was a movie sort of, well, very loose.
Sort of.
Kind of, sort of not. But anyway, I think people have heard that there was some sort of UFO event over L.A. back in the early 40s. And indeed, there was a significant UFO encounter in February 1942, just a few months after Pearl Harbor. The country was right on edge. There were Japanese ships, you know, off the coast, periodically being seen. And on one evening, on February 25th, going into the 26th, there were, on varying accounts, either one or some have said multiple objects that were in the sky that were seen through field glasses by a lot of military personnel. And there were 1,430 rounds of artillery that were fired at this thing. And it never came down. There was no recovery, it was reported. The military said, the U.S. Navy the next day said, well, it was war nerves, whatever that means. In other words, apparently that there was nothing there. But there was something there. And, you know, officially what that something was has never really come down to us. I mean, there have been some alleged leaked documents of unknown, untried provenance that have said one thing or another. But what we really don't know, except that there was an event there, that the U.S. military lied to the public about it. And you really could say that the UFO cover-up began not later than that moment.
You have General George Marshall writing to Franklin D. Roosevelt in a memo, right?
Yeah, and he said, speculating, could these have been Japanese planes?
I think you said it's unidentified airplanes were probably over Los Angeles, is quoting the memo. So
exactly,
something
yes,
was flying
exactly.
Around.
But in Marshall's memo, he had no identification of those aircraft. That was the thing. So these were literally unidentified flying craft, unidentified flying objects that were over Los Angeles. And what's interesting is, think about it. If these were airplanes and you're shooting over 1,000 rounds of artillery at them, you're going to bring them down, right? I mean, it's going to come down. What we have is that one famous photograph of an object over Los Angeles. You've got these very, very intense search beams that are focused on an object. And you see the artillery, bursts around it, those little circular things. And you see the thing in the middle, and it sure as heck looks like a saucer type of an object. There's no other way to describe it other than that. Now, is that what it was? Again, we don't know. It's a photograph. It's a neat photograph. But again, it does show that this was a significant phenomenon. Now, there was an argument, and I raised this in my book here, that what people saw were, in fact, balloons that were sent aloft, that were lighted, that confused some of the nervous artillery guys and someone, you know, they fired when they didn't mean to fire, and it started a barrage. I do look at that argument. I analyze it. And it's not a valid argument because, first of all, the times are not right. You still have radar trackings of unknowns coming in off the coast of Los Angeles. It's easy to forget that. There are sightings of something coming in just before you see this object over L.A. So, and there's much more to this, but the long and short of it is that this is, I don't think that this is an easily explainable as balloons, not at all. We have something where the Navy and the military clapped down some secrecy about this right out of the gate.
You know, the significance, as I mentioned going into the break, of these documents, this paper trail existing before anyone knew the FOIA would ever exist, they figured they had privacy here, so they're much more candid about what they wrote. And there are a number of documents related to UFO incidents from those early days.
This is what got me going, just like what got you going, those documents. Back 20 years ago, when I said to myself, I wasn't planning to be a UFO researcher. I just thought, I'm interested in this. I happened to be studying American Cold War history. At that time, I was studying Harry Truman and the Soviets. And I thought, well, you have these claims of cover-up, so let's find out, do these researchers have a case or not? It was really that simple. I thought I would take a little bit of time out of my life to do this. And like you, I found the declassified documents through Freedom of Information, which people must realize was an accident of history, the Freedom of Information Act. And as you said, the originators of these documents in the 40s and 50s, they had every expectation that these documents would never be shown to the public. So what did we find? In the late 70s, we got a bunch of these documents released. We have the famous memo from 1947 by General Nathan Twining. He was 3 stars at the time. He later became 4 stars and head of the U.S. Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Nathan Twining, in September 1947, was writing back to another general who had inquired about these so-called flying saucers, basically wanting to know what was up with those. And Twining writes back a 3-page memo in which he states point blank, this phenomenon is real, not visionary or fictitious. That statement by itself should be known by every single American, every single educated person in the world. The phenomenon is real, not visionary or fictitious. So this is at a time when the U.S. military was telling the world that it was visionary, that it was fictitious. Here you have the head of Air Materiel Command at Wright Airfield saying no. He goes on and describes the what the military reports were saying about these flying saucers, such as evasive when sighted, disc-shaped, domed on top and flat on bottom. So what in September 1947 is going to be domed on top and flat on bottom? Good question. Nothing was supposed to be, and yet here you have this general saying so. Silent or nearly silent, exceptional performance capabilities. So what you have right in that document is a point-blank statement by one of America's top military commanders at that time, attesting to the reality of it. And it just goes on from there. There's an FBI memo from early 1949 that says this matter, flying saucers, is considered top secret by Army intelligence, by the intelligence community, and then goes on to describe a whole array of unbelievable violations of sensitive airspace by these unconventional objects. My favorite of them, if we can say the favorite, is a 1952 CIA memo that was to the director of the CIA, who at the time was Walter Bedell Smith, and it was by his director of scientific intelligence, a man named H. Marshall Chadwell, who says, at this time, reports of unknown objects in the vicinity of sensitive installations are of such nature, he says, that they are not attributable to natural phenomena or known types of aerial vehicles. It's one of the most upfront statements on this that you could imagine, other than saying, boss, I think we're being invaded. He didn't say that in this memo, but he might as well. He's talking about real objects over sensitive installations that are not natural phenomena and that are not anything that they knew of in terms of technology.
You had a whole series of green fireballs over sensitive installations, New Mexico nuclear installations, a guy named Lincoln LaPaz who studied it.
They call them green fireballs, but the question is, what were they really? You have these low objects horizontal, way slower than any kind of meteorite or atmospheric object would move, but low horizontal, leaving a green trail. And it was a real head scratcher. And what we know, yes, Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, out of the University of New Mexico, and a number of other military scientists studied this phenomenon. And they were very, very serious about it. What we don't have is a released report of their findings, but we do know from a number of sources that they were deeply concerned about this, and many of them did not consider this natural phenomenon. And that's at Los Alamos. Then you have Oak Ridge, another nuclear area of our technology, and then you have the Hanford Atomic Energy Facility in the state of Washington. All of these and others were the scene of repeated violations of their airspace by unconventional-looking, unusual objects that had incredible capabilities that would hang out over their airspace and then take off. If we were in charge of the air security, think about it. We could not tell the public. That's a recipe for panic. We would want to keep as much control over this situation as possible. Meanwhile, doing everything we could do to figure this out. And, you'd have to keep this ultra secret. And that's exactly what they have had to do all of these years.
Or tried. Get the cliche, why don't they land on the White House lawn? And of course, 1952, they certainly flew over it, this huge flap right over the nation's capital.
Indeed.
And it's pretty instructive how the government responded. They had a big news conference and they explained it away as temperature inversion. And I know in your book, you said that you were able to track down the last surviving air traffic controller who worked during these two consecutive weekends.
That's correct. His name was Howard Coughlin, and he passed away just, I think, 2 months after I was able to interview him. That was incredible. I have a link to that interview in the footnotes of the book. But yes, I mean, the fact is, on July 19th/20th and then 26th/27th of 1952, at least on those 2 weekends in a row, there were multiple unknown, unconventional, and seemingly extraordinary objects that were over the airspace of Washington, D.C., indeed, over the Capitol building, from all the reports that we have. We have air traffic that saw this. We have military and civilian air traffic. You had the ground-based radar that were tracking it as well. Howard Coughlin was one of those people. And Howard, in fact, told me that he had a visual on the object and that it looked unlike any airplane that he and his colleagues had ever seen. It, in his opinion, it looked, I think the words that he said, it looked saucer-like. Certainly, it didn't look like an airplane. But that's just a visual. But you, in other words, you have visual and you have radar, and you have multiple radars on some of these objects, aircraft being scrambled to intercept. And then what happens? The military is outclassed by them. They can't compete with these things. And it makes the headlines of the New York Times has this as their headline, incredibly. So the Air Force has to put it all to sleep, and they have their famous press conference on the 29th of July, in which General John Samford, who later headed up the NSA, gives a big press conference, and he says, yes, this appears to be a weather phenomenon known as temperature inversion, in which a layer of cold air is trapped between layers of warm air, and it causes radar to go screwy. The radar operators, all of them, at least all of the ones that we've been able to get statements from, all disagreed with that. But they were not allowed to speak at the press conference. End of the story. A little interesting side note of that press conference is that along there with Samford was another general named Roger Ramey. And Roger Ramey was the guy who ran the who told the media 5 years earlier that the Roswell crash was simply a weather balloon. And it's a really odd thing when you ask yourself, why would Roger Ramey now be in D.C. in 1952 with John Samford? He's doing damage control on the UFO phenomenon, and he's
An old hand at this by now.
Yeah, exactly.
I was encouraged, Richard, that you're not a guy who just works in dusty archives. You get out there and you track down witnesses. This guy, Howard Cochran, being an example. And I'm jumping out of order here, but there's another guy you interviewed more recently, Anonymous, the Anonymous interview, and it was recorded by a friend of mine, Jeremy Corbell, who recorded
Yes.
it. And I know we're jumping out of order, but what do you think about that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that. This gentleman was someone who had been interviewed at great length years before by Linda Moulton Howe, when he was quite a bit healthier and in much better spirits. And then, he dropped out because he said that he had been threatened by, I guess we could say, men in black, and went hiding. I didn't really know anything about this man until I was contacted through Jeremy and through Stephen Bassett, who was also involved in setting this up. And they asked if I would be able to do an interview with this man. And at this point, his health was very, very bad, and it was believed that he was possibly dying. So I agreed to go and do it. And yeah, he had, we met at a very exclusive remote location in northern U.S. On the way there, actually, we didn't know if he would be able to do the interview at all. There was a lot of questions as we were driving up there, a long, long, long drive, even if he would be able to do it, if he would agree to do it, if his family would let him. Ugh. So I finally meet with him in a motel room, and I have to tell you, there were several times during that interview when I actually. When he coughed so badly, I didn't know if he would make it. I was actually afraid for his health. But his story was simple. In the late 1950s, he was with the U.S. Army, and I have his military records. I have his DD-214, which shows he was in the U.S. Army during that period of time. What he then said is that he was recruited via the Army into the CIA. Not as a direct employee per se, but I don't know what the exact type of arrangement. He had a boss who was a CIA station chief. He worked under this guy, and his job was to initially to receive UFO reports coming in from Europe. Now that actually makes perfect sense to me. Europe would be a domain of the CIA. We do know CIA did collect UFO reports from Europe. He said that's what I did. He said he saw photographs of landed saucers. One photograph, he said, actually had an alien, what seemed like an alien being, in Italy. And then he said it got a little crazier, that he and his boss were asked, or his boss was asked by President Eisenhower, this is the very late 1950s, to investigate Area 51. Why? According to what this man said, Ike had tried and failed to get information about the ET-related programs at Area 51, was frustrated with the lack of response, and wanted these two to go. And if he didn't get a good answer from them, he was going to send in the U.S. Army to invade Area 51. This is exactly what this man said to me. And when he said this to me, my eyebrows probably went into my hairline. I was just like, are you kidding me? He had a lot more to say about his trip there, about what he saw. He said he saw a Roswell craft. He said he saw a live being behind the glass, I mean, and more. Now, here's the thing. I don't believe this man is a liar. I don't believe he was in any way intentionally fabricating anything. I think he might even have been truthful about some of what he said. I don't know. The problem that I have with this is it's one man's story. I have not been able to get a corroboration of a plan to invade Area 51. Wouldn't shock me, actually, when you know the end of the last few years of Eisenhower's presidency. He had serious problems, actually, in controlling his own military
Well, yeah,
and really lost
the
control.
famous warning, the military-industrial complex. We will continue. Yeah,
Absolutely.
let's continue the conversation about the anonymous interview by Jeremy Corbell and some of the other implications, and then we'll get into some new cases coming up in the next hour. The birds take us into the break. Our conversation with Richard Dolan continues here on Coast to Coast AM.